Abraham Lincoln tricked the so-called Negro into thinking that he was free. And when you read some of the books that were written by the so-called Negro historian J.E. Rogers, one of his books, God, the Africa's Gift to America, he points out plainly how Abraham Lincoln did nothing but trick the Negro, fool the Negro, and use the Negro, the same as every other politician who has been in the White House has been tricking and fooling and using the Negro as a political football ever since America has been America.
The black people Malcolm X is talking about represented at the time some 22 million persons. Today, this number has doubled, and with more than 2 million African-American inhabitants, New York City has the highest urban black population in the United States. This cosmopolitan city owes as much to its builders as to the people who, like Malcolm, left their imprint in and on the city. It was in New York City that Malcolm X made his entrance, and it was in New York that Malcolm X was killed. This film is dedicated to him. It will attempt to show the extraordinary evolution of his political vision over nearly 10 years, and to ask questions, once more and forever, about the reasons for his murder. Was he killed by his brothers, or were the orders given by much more powerful people? Regardless, together with Martin Luther King, Malcolm X will remain one of the most important black leaders in contemporary history.
What makes the so-called Negro unable to stand on his own two feet? He has no self-confidence. He has no proud confidence in his own race. Because the white man destroyed your and my past, destroyed our knowledge of our culture. And by having destroyed it, now we don't know we have any achievement, any accomplishment. And as long as you can be convinced that you never did anything, you can never do anything.
During the 50s and the 60s, many demonstrations, each time more impressive, drove Martin Luther King and his followers through the towns and villages of the South of the United States. By preaching civil disobedience, they were defying the system. The demonstrators were requesting that black people be granted access to schools and universities, but also the right to vote, which was still denied them in many states. The long walk of the black militants through the southern states was punctuated with serious incidents. Prisons and the judicial system were nearly paralyzed. As for the northern states, and especially in big cities like New York, extreme right groups unleashed terror worse than the Ku Klux Klan in the south. The violence was such that Martin Luther King didn't dare venture there to build his movement.
This is why I say it's the ballot or the bullet. It's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
He stands in the doorway of the dressing room, listening to Benjamin 2X warm up the crowd with inspirational metaphor and promises of eternal paradise. Something feels wrong out there, he tells those around him. Then the minister quietly moves behind the rostrum, takes a seat, assembles his notes, and prepares himself to take center stage, as he has done for the past 12 long years.
Just as Benjamin was ending his speech, the four of us was relieved. Malcolm was being introduced. He came on the stage. Two individuals about four or five rows back started a commotion, "Get your hands out my pocket, nigga." I started walking towards them, and all of a sudden I see three individuals up front pumping shots at Malcolm. And they were moving from Malcolm's right toward the center aisle.
And I heard a voice, and I think that voice either had to be Earl Grant's or Brother Reuben's. And I heard him say, "Stop that guy, he just shot Malcolm."
I jumped up, I ran down to the stage. I jumped up on the stage and I saw him laying there. By this time, Mrs. Koshiyama had his head kind of in her lap. And someone had pulled his shirt open and I saw all these bullet holes in his chest.
And then I started to give him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. And after maybe about 5 minutes, I'd say it was over.
3 p.m. on February 21st, 1965, at the Audubon Ballroom, Malcolm X, male Negro, 39 years of age, was shot and killed as he was on the stage at the main ballroom. 13 of these shots taking effect.
He was murdered by the FBI, by the New York City police, and by CIA agents.
Malcolm X's real name was Malcolm Little. He was born in 1925 in Omaha, Nebraska. His childhood was tormented. His father, a Baptist minister already very involved in the Black Liberation Movement, was murdered. He would for the first time hear about the Nation of Islam. After serving two-thirds of his sentence, Malcolm was released from prison in 1952. He met with Elijah Muhammad, founder of the Nation of Islam, a movement better known as the Black Muslims. Malcolm dropped his former name of Little, that he considered to be a slave's name, and replaced it by the letter X, which corresponded to the lost African name of American black people.
He rose quickly to the organization's ranks. Elijah gave him the freedom to travel and preach. With missionary zeal, he converted multitudes on ghetto street corners and established temples and businesses for the faithful. He served as minister of the Harlem Temple in New York City, and the organization gained visibility and wealth with him as a star attraction.
He asked me to compile folders on different aspects of history.
The Muslims who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad don't see any way in which the so-called Emancipation Proclamation that Lincoln allegedly made 100 years ago has freed our people or has done anything good for our people.
He went outside and got it, but he did not become less a Muslim. But he knew there was a whole lot of non-Muslims who were sympathetic toward him, who would furnish him information. At this point, the Nation of Islam wasn't a religion, but a sect and a cult. Malcolm X was the appointed spokesman for the Nation. And he had taken an organization with 7 mosques and maybe less than 2,000 people.
But Malcolm was able to take that and move it into large numbers.
Elijah Muhammad, and this is to his credit, had created a form of Islam that communicated to his black constituency. And this Islam might resemble the Orthodox a little less than mist resembles rain. But it did communicate. It did create the means for a whole lot of people to reclaim themselves and people to come out of prisons and be men again and be whole again.
I was a student at Howard University when the sit-in started in Greensboro by the North Carolina A&T students in Greensboro, North Carolina. And I was a member of that group that used to picket Woolworths in Washington to show our support for the brothers down in Greensboro. That was my first political activism, was doing that. And then when I had come to New York, I had been involved in some of the different things that was going on up there. But so I was mainly, I guess, was part of what, for want of a better term, the Martin Luther King wing of the movement. But even before I actually got involved with Brother Malcolm, I had begun to become kind of, disillusioned with that kind of total nonviolence approach to the whole thing. And not just that, but also, the analysis of what was going on just did not make as much sense to me as what he was saying, his analysis of the system and how it worked. I first heard Brother Malcolm speak in the summer of 1962. Now, of course, we had both heard of Malcolm X at this time, mostly negative stuff. He was the boogeyman who hated all white folks and was calling them devils and that kind of thing. And so we decided to hear what he had to say. And by the time he finished, he spoke over 2 hours. It was a warm June, very warm, hot, really. And by the time he finished, I said to myself, and I said to my roommate, he makes more sense And his analysis of, you know, the racial situation makes more sense than anything I've ever heard anyone say. Anyone.
What makes the so-called Negro unable to stand on his own two feet? He has no self-confidence. He has no proud confidence in his own race. Because the white man destroyed your and my past. Destroyed our knowledge of our culture. And by having destroyed it, now we don't know we have any achievement, any accomplishment. And as long as you can be convinced that you never did anything, you can never do anything.
There comes a time in all mass movements when fires of passion cool, a time when bureaucracy and vested interests take over. By the early 1960s, the leadership of Elijah Muhammad's lost foundation had grown fat and comfortable. The minister of Harlem's Temple No. 7 and national spokesman for the nation could not shut his eyes to the ethical contradictions nor the corruption which had woven its way into the core of the movement.
They knew because Malcolm was an honest man, he would do some house cleaning. He might clean them out.
A number of Elijah's secretaries had become pregnant and are expelled from the nation on charges of committing adultery and fornication. The minister meets with the women, and upon being told by them that Elijah is the father of their children, he goes to Phoenix to see the man who had reclaimed, redeemed, and resurrected him from mental and spiritual death. At Elijah's estate in Arizona, the old man counsels his minister that many biblical prophets and patriarchs also had shortcomings. Back home in New York, the minister repeats what Elijah told him to two nation officials, the captain of Temple No. 7's FOI, Joseph X, and the Boston minister, Louis X. They say they already know the truth about Elijah and the women, and then they report the minister at the national headquarters in Chicago for spreading rumor and causing doubt and dissension among the faithful.
But an event was about to change the rules. Even though Elijah Muhammad had sent a letter to all his ministers asking them never to say anything bad about President Kennedy, on the day after the president's assassination, Malcolm X declared that the violence President Kennedy was never able to contain had backfired on him. Elijah Muhammad immediately suspended his minister from the organization.
Well, I said the same thing that everybody says, that his assassination was the result of the climate of hate. But I said the chickens came home to roost, and which means the same thing.
So it was expedient to find something on him that could get him suspended or removed or demoted in some form. It wasn't just that instance that caused his suspension. It had been building up to that point. And the national secretary was there, who went back to John Ali, who went back to Chicago and told Mr. Muhammad that Malcolm had spoke out against President Kennedy. He was given a 90-day suspension.
He had told Elijah Muhammad previously that we have something going here that can be of great service to our people, and we should not destroy it with any dissension between the two of us. I think all of Malcolm X's letters were intercepted and all of his tapes were intercepted.
I didn't leave, number one. I was put out, no matter, and since there was no justification for them putting me out, they had to make it appear to the public that I left of my own volition.
Noticing the drift of his brothers belonging to the black Muslims, Malcolm X was more worried about the future of the black cause than hurt by his suspension. It was time for him to think things over. He felt he needed to recharge his batteries, to return to basics. He also acknowledged the fact that apart from the clash over Kennedy's death, there was a real split between Elijah Muhammad and himself, a separation between the mentor and his follower, an existential rupture between father and son.
In 1964, Following his break with the nation, the minister performs a pilgrimage to the sacred mosque in Mecca. He sees multitudes of men and women of all colors and races from all over the earth, united in spirit and purpose. One humanity, one human family worshiping Allah. Sages show him scripture in the Quran and sayings of the original prophet Muhammad of 14 centuries ago. Sayings and scriptures which contradict teachings he learned at the feet of Elijah Muhammad. He now declares himself a true Muslim. The schism is complete and final. And for the remainder of his life, he would attract increased attention from United States government agents and would deal with constant threats from those he had left behind in the nation.
When I was on the pilgrimage, I had close contact with Muslims whose skin would in America be classified as white, and with Muslims who themselves would be classified as white in America. But these particular Muslims didn't call themselves white. They looked upon themselves as human beings, as part of the human family, and therefore they looked upon all other segments of the human family as part of that same family. Well, now, they had a different look or a different air or a different attitude than that which is reflected in the attitude of the man in America who calls himself white. So I said that if Islam had done that for them, perhaps if the white man in America would study Islam, perhaps they could do the same thing for him.
I was at the press conference. He would find the Muslim Mosque Incorporation and the Organization of African American Unity, patterned after the Organization of African Unity.
As a matter of fact, only a few months after having created the basis for a new church, Malcolm X repositioned his action on the political level. The statutes of his organization were barely established when he defined his two new goals. One, include the fight of African Americans in a concerted effort to liberate oppressed people in Africa and in the Third World. And two, most of all, give that effort an international dimension. Each time Malcolm saw that his audience understood the relationship between the African organization and his own African American organization, he was as happy as a child.
The OAU was not made up of Muslims. It was made up of just indigenous people that weren't Muslims. And some of them were nationalists, and he didn't really care what their beliefs were. But this was a political organization that was designed to gain acceptance at the United Nations as a non-governmental organization. You know, you can have an office there. We weren't to talk to them about religion, because it wasn't about that. It was just political, cultural, that kind of.
As if drawn by an irresistible force, Malcolm X left again for Africa. Over 6 months he crossed Africa from east to west. To all his brothers he proclaimed, "I do not consider myself as an American. I am one of the 22 million black people who are the victims of Americanism." Everywhere he received a triumphal welcome. It was the occasion for him to define his new policy. He did not want black people to go back to Africa, as Marcus Garvey wished. Nor did he want pacifist integration in the Martin Luther King style. African Americans who went from slavery to diaspora should remain in the United States to fight for their rights, but also to reclaim their origin, their roots. It was time for African Americans to become an integral part of all Africans across the world. Just for the record, Malcolm X would call one of his daughters Lumumba.
Well, I've gotten a good reaction, a very sympathetic reaction, and an understanding reaction. Many of them had been misinformed by the American government into thinking that black people in America don't identify with Africa, and therefore they've restrained themselves from voicing their interest in our problem. But I've impressed upon them that our problem is their problem, as well as their problems are our problems.
And here was Brother Malcolm traveling around through Africa, equating, and in essence, saying that the United States was in no position to be talking, you know, telling the rest of the world, giving the rest of the world lectures because of the things that were going on in this country.
He had gotten the pledge of 8 African nations to take the case of Black America before the United Nations as a human rights case, as against a civil rights case. And I do not think this nation wanted to suffer the embarrassment of having that done.
When Malcolm X returned from his African tour, which caused a considerable stir in the American press, the State Department was intensely alarmed. Informers in Harlem spoke of funds being given to Black extremist groups during the riots, which came from certain African embassies belonging to the United Nations. The State Department thought the matter so politically sensitive that President Johnson was informed. He, in turn, asked J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI, to uncover any further information. The situation was so tense that anything could happen at any time.
Our desire, our prayer, that we can have a peaceful, intelligent rally here this afternoon. But at the same time, we see that they have surrounded us with many of their own agents, in uniform and out of uniform.
Intelligence agencies were famous for infiltrating top agents among the leaders of extremist movements. But some agencies, such as the FBI, also adopted the technique of infiltrating basic informers. First, the informer would linger around the community. Once accepted, he would simply go to meetings and collect as much information as possible.
I was recruited into BASI after I had taken the standard entrance exam for police officers. And then we took the battery of tests. And then one day they called, 3 people I didn't know that were from BASI called me down to the old police headquarters, and they asked me some questions, and what did I feel about certain things. And one of the final questions was, what did I feel about Malcolm X? And I said, I didn't know that much about the man. And then after which, the following week, they said, we want you to try to get into Malcolm's organization, which was in the Teresa Hotel. So my next visit, I go to Malcolm's office in the Teresa Hotel, and I meet a fellow and express the fact that I wanted to join the organization. He gave me a questionnaire form to fill out, which I did. And then I started attending meetings.
Gene Roberts, of course, identity as a guard for Malcolm, undercover guard, never came out for about 6 years after Malcolm's death, when he was a witness doing the same kind of work in what's called the Panther 21 trial here in New York.
With Gene Roberts as a trusted bodyguard, the New York City police now had a man on the inside who could closely monitor the activities of the Muslim Mosque Incorporated, the OAAU, and the minister as well.